thousands of years. Sovereignty was never ceded, and their struggle to maintain their connection to country throughout history and up to the present day deserves respect. So we pay our respect to the elders, past, present and emerging. Thanks for joining us tonight. My name's Erin. I'm the lead organiser for the 100 Jobs Alliance and will MC tonight. As most of you already know, the 100 Jobs Alliance is working to maintain well-paid, secure jobs in the Hunter as the energy market is changing. Actually, while I've got you, I also want to introduce our new coordinator, Justin Page. If you want to just wave your hand, stand up. A lot of you may know Warwick already, who's still here, can't keep away, but yeah, it will help continue that work because there's a lot of work ahead of us to achieve that goal, maintaining those jobs in the Hunter. And we're pleased now to have the Federal Net Zero Authority Agency to do some of that work, as well as the commitment at the state level for a local authority to make best use of our local expertise in planning for the future. So we're looking forward to more detail on that. We know that as the Hunter economy changes, the type of work our people will do will change, and so their skills and qualifications will need to change. Investors are looking at the region right now and are weighing up whether the skills are here for their future needs. But the current state of vocational education and training falls short and isn't adequate to either reskill workers moving out of traditional industries or provide the kind of workforce required for the industries of the future. I'll let our speakers elaborate a lot more on all this, but those are just a couple of reasons why the Hunter Jobs Alliance is calling for a bricks and mortar new industries training centre to be established in the Hunter. It could be the main location in New South Wales for training workers in renewable energy, offshore wind, hydrogen and related manufacturing. And it should make use of existing TAFE facilities and expertise, connect up with the University of Newcastle and ensure industry participation and data-driven workforce planning. We can talk a bit more about that particular policy ask of ours and the campaign later. But first, to give you some background and introduce our speakers tonight, we've got Chris Briggs, Sheena Martin, Lee Shears and Warwick Jordan. But first we'll hear from Chris, and I'll just introduce him now. He's the Research Director and Energy Futures Program Lead at the Institute for Sustainable Futures, University of Technology, Sydney, and the Technical Director, Business Renewable Centre Australia. Chris has worked in climate and energy roles as a policy advisor, policy maker, program leader and researcher, and was also a labour market analyst, including at the Australian Research Council Research Fellow at the Workplace Research Centre, University of Sydney. So, take it away. Move that if you need to.
Thank you. And I also used to work at the AMW, actually. I can see quite a few AMW people here, but many years ago.
Let's just turn it up.
In the days of Doug Cameron. I'd like to start by...
Do you want me to drive it?
Thanks, everyone. Yeah, I'd like to start also by acknowledging the traditional owners, the Wanneroo people upon whom we meet tonight. I think my role here is to give a bit of an overview of the workforce and skills dimensions of the energy transition that we're starting to accelerate through before setting up other speakers and discussion here tonight. Just a little bit of background about where I'm from. I'm from something called the Institute for Sustainable Futures. It's basically a university consultancy. It does commissioned research for governments, for industry, unions, community groups and others. I'm covering a whole range of things from technical studies and modelling on energy systems through to social research, a full gamut of things. There's a list of some of the things that we do quite a bit of work on employment dimensions of clean energy or the energy system. So we've done modelling and projections for the Energy Market Operator and Infrastructure Australia, and we've done quite a bit of work for different New South Wales government agencies like Energy Co on skill strategies for rolling out the renewable energy zones and how to maximise local jobs through the transition. I've included links for the three people in the audience that like to read reports afterwards. I presume the slides will get spread. So we have now reached a point where we've got alignment between governments and the energy system on what they're trying to do. Federal government, state government and energy market institutions all have a target of over 80% renewable energy by 2030. We're about 35% now. So fundamentally they're aiming to transform our energy system in the next 7 years which is not very long in the life of an energy system. And along with that, of course, that means not only a rapid transition in the energy system, it means a rapid development of a workforce, either in mostly in inland areas where we don't really have much tradition of energy infrastructure, the Central West, the New England, Southwest, or in places like the Hunter where they're looking to retool and redeploy areas which do have a body of energy skills. As you'd probably be very aware, we have skill shortages across most of the key occupations that are going to work in energy. We have what Infrastructure Australia calls an unprecedented pipeline of infrastructure construction underway, never been built before. And so at the time where we're trying to accelerate the energy transition, they're running into a range of problems, but one of which is also developing the workforce that's required. So there's three, I guess there's three different types of movements or transitions happening here. One is happening right now in front of our faces, which is trying to build out and construct renewable energy storage and transmission infrastructure. Second one is how do we manage the transition and decline and redeployment of the coal and gas workforce as that happens, which is sort of short to medium term. And then there's sort of a longer time frame where we're trying to build a workforce to grow new sectors like hydrogen, offshore wind, or a battery, you know, a full battery supply chain which involves mining and mineral processing and manufacturing, but also the re-emergence really of traditional industries like steel manufacturing. As the world shifts to renewable energy, it's going to become more difficult and expensive to transport energy, and Australia with its very high quality renewables should have a comparative advantage in energy costs that gives us a real opportunity to rebuild things like steel and aluminium. So what I'm going to do is to run through some employment projections, I guess, to give you a sense of the volumes of jobs and the types of jobs that we're talking about. Secondly, talk about some of the challenges. And three, touch on some of the policy options that we've been recommending governments take up to try and make the most of this transition and build local jobs. A little bit of context. So this graph comes from the Energy Market Operator. They have a thing called the Integrated System Plan, which is like their blueprint where they're trying to work out how the energy system changes. And I put this graph up, I guess, to illustrate just how quickly they see potentially coal-fired power stations closing down. You can see the black line at the top there, which is the announced retirements. But because no one in the energy system actually believes that's what's going to happen, they've been running a whole lot of other scenarios about what they think might happen. You can see one called progressive change, one called slow change, which is still faster, step change and hydrogen superpower. And the step change scenario is the one essentially that everyone is working towards, the federal government, state government and the energy market institutions. So if you look at that purple line coming down, you can see most of the coal-fired power station capacity closes by the early 2030s, and then there's another chunk by the mid-2030s and a little bit left over from there. So really in the next 10 years, they're looking at closing down most of our coal-fired power stations. So far, I think that the transition's been relatively gentle because it's a tight labour market and contractors can be redeployed and power station operators can be moved to another power station. But obviously, as it starts to bite, that will get harder and that will get more difficult. There's a longer transition, of course, for the coal mining sector. Only around a quarter of the coal is mined for domestic consumption. But the same trends will come at some point, and history tells us that these things are rarely linear and smooth. And I think the group that I worry about is all the sort of semi-skilled machine operators in the sector for whom there isn't always an obvious, you know, transition path. There might be other types of mining and we can build them, but they're not going to be as easy to move as the electricians who work in power stations, for example. This is the flip side then of where the energy market operator sees the power system going. You can see a lot of yellow for solar, a lot of wind, a lot of green for wind, and then different types of storage. The sort of purple there for coordinated storage, which means that the power grid operators will be able to control it. Distributed storage, which is like batteries on people's homes or in their neighbourhoods. Utility scale storage, which is large scale batteries. So, and you can see the black and the brown then disappearing through the mid-30s as we saw on the other graph. So what we're doing really is moving from a system where we had a base load of coal and then peaking plants, gas and hydro on top of it, to one where the bulk power comes out of variable sources, and then we have flexible sources like storage that are going to fill in the gaps instead. So it's a big transition, and you can see to achieve it, we need to double renewables every decade to achieve this scenario. If you want to talk about the hydrogen superpower scenario, which is the one where we end up exporting a lot of energy and a lot of commodities overseas, then they're talking about building another as many as another 4, 5, 6 times this capacity on top of it. So this is just to transform our own system, let alone to gear up for potential export. That then translates across into jobs. On the left, there's a couple of graphs that we did for the energy market operator. The red line up the top graph shows you the overall level of jobs, and it's pretty similar. It sort of oscillates up and down, but what's changing, of course, is the composition of jobs. So you've got a couple of sharp spurts of growth for renewables, mostly solar and wind farms. Rooftop solar is now very steady as a source of employment. It used to go through a lot of boom and bust, and now it's very steady. We've got the highest per capita take-up of solar in the world, and it just keeps on rolling. You can see the purple line, again, there's a couple of like ups and downs for building out storage. And then the light blue line down the bottom is transmission. So less jobs there, but again, you need a few thousand in quite a short space of time, and we haven't built transmission lines in a very long time. So they're not enormous numbers when you look at them, except when you think that you've got to, you know, grab 5,000 in a few years, essentially, if you're gonna achieve these scenarios. And the way the industry's typically done it is to move the workforce around the country, essentially. So we don't really have these volumes sitting around, and these workers are in high competition with other sectors who will often pay better than the renewable sector, so quite challenging. The graphs on the right show you the mix by phase. So all the light blue is the construction phase. As you know, there's a lot of jobs in the build-out phase. But the interesting part to me is the brown, which is the ongoing operations and maintenance jobs. And so obviously wind farms don't employ as many people as coal-fired power stations to do this, but as you just keep building and building them, of course you build the workforce. So by the time you get into the next decade, the middle of the next decade, around one in two of these jobs is actually an ongoing operation and maintenance job. We've got a very small green slither there for manufacturing, which is based on existing local capacity. You know, it doesn't project what we think might happen, and now that we have a government that seems committed to this, then we probably, you know, you might well see that, we would hope to see that green slither grow. What type of jobs will be created? On the left there, you can see by some margin, the largest category is trades and technicians, electricians, mechanical trades, next professionals and managers, labourers. Machine operators and drivers are the only category which shrinks, which reflects the large proportion of the coal sector relative to renewables. And the different colours in the licorice all sort tell you which technology they're working in. So the biggest you can see in the green there is wind, and then the sort of lightish pink is rooftop solar. But the basis, I guess, of this is that arguably the main role in generating skill and jobs is in the vocational education and training system, because most of these jobs are trades and technicians. We don't have very good data on jobs outside of renewable supply, so there's a whole lot of other types of jobs on which we don't really have very good data. So there's going to be a wave of electrification that moves through people's homes and businesses as we switch to electric hot water, cooking, vehicles. You can imagine millions of houses going through this process, what sort of employment that is going to create. It's going to be like another rooftop solar industry. Energy management. The US does collect data on this, and there's many more jobs in this than there are in renewables. So these are like auditors or facility managers who look after energy. They're scattered all through the economy, so they're not as visible as a wind farm or a solar farm. Onshore wind isn't included in those projections because the energy market operator doesn't have them in their scenarios because they're more expensive than onshore at the moment, and there's a debate around how that'll play out within the energy system. There's a lot of money looking to develop it. We did do some projections for a developer last year. On the right, you can see around what we estimated out of a 2,000 megawatt offshore wind farm is it would create about 1,600 jobs in construction, around 600 in building the transmission, about 150 ongoing jobs. And then the manufacturing depends on whether you develop the local capacity. It was probably only like, we reckon, about 100 jobs based on existing local capacity. We sort of went through each type of activity and made an estimate. But if you were to develop local capacity, you could get up to around 1,000 jobs, we think, in manufacturing for a single large-scale offshore wind farm. And I'll skip past the other ones, but there's a whole range of other opportunities that I think we're only really starting to understand at this point and aren't really factored into the projections and the planning at this point. So some of the challenges, scaling up a regional workforce for renewables will have its challenges. What we did here was to compare the existing size of the workforce in key occupations like electricians, construction managers, the core occupations, that's these red blocks, and then we overlaid it with the projections on how much employment was going to be created within each of the regions. So if you look at the New England one, you can see the peak generated by the renewables is like 2.5 times the entire existing workforce. And of course, they're not sitting around doing nothing. They're electricians working in people's homes and fairly stretched. So it's a very difficult context in which to actually generate local jobs and benefits. And it's a similar story in most of those regional areas, except when you come around to the Hunter, of course, because this is a base of traditional energy skills. And it does kind of raise, to me, the possibility that the Hunter might not only be generating jobs for itself, but it might actually be generating skilled labour to go inland and build out the infrastructure elsewhere, because it's a natural hub. So genuinely challenging to build a local workforce for the renewables in most of these regions, which don't have this tradition. Secondly, we need to dramatically upscale the capacity in the training system. Renewable energy is what they call a thin market, which means you've got not that much, over many years you've had not that much demand, it's spread out over these regions, no one knows if projects are going to get built or not with all the politics and stuff, so of course you don't get the training capacity because it just looks too uncertain. So there's a range of gaps. There's gaps in the availability of trades training in many areas. I should say a lot of this work comes from inland regions because that's where people are focused on at the moment, but I think a lot of it is still applicable here. There's gaps in basic qualifications, like wind technicians. There's gaps in infrastructure. So when we talked to people who do transmission training, they said there's not a single tower in New South Wales in which you can train a transmission line worker, for example. And there's gaps in trainers. There's training shortages. So there's a pretty dramatic job needed to build the capacity of our VOC educational training system to try and build the workforce that's needed. And then if you turn to the sort of newer sectors, of course, like the battery sector or offshore wind, our training system, of course, was never designed for these sectors. And so there's all this new capacity that needs to be built to service them. Am I going for time? 7 minutes. Oh, that's not too bad. So what are some of the options then? I've given you the dimensions of the problem and all the barriers which you always hear about. We, I guess, centre on 5 recommendations, and in the interest of time, I'm going to just focus on 3 of them. We do talk quite a bit about coordination between industry and government and trading stakeholders because it's a really fragmented, fractured labour market and system. And we constantly hear from people saying we need to build better coordination between them if we're going to be able to build the workforce. But I'll focus more on the training and workforce development capacity. And I thought, given the focus of the 100 Jobs Alliance, I'd focus on some of what we heard in our field work on training centres. So we interviewed every proponent for every renewables energy developer, every transmission bidder, and a whole lot of regional stakeholders for EnergyCo, who's doing the build-out in the Central West. And I think pretty much all of them said they wanted to see some training centres or equivalent built in the region. Developers were drawing on experience here, but also elsewhere, saying it's very hard to get people to attend training, particularly young people to attend training. If the facilities aren't local, they're not going to travel. So on the other side, the regional stakeholders were very worried about the potential for it just to become a fly-in, fly-out construction boom, particularly given how tight their labour market was. But they'll suffer all the consequences of the housing shortages and the construction impacts and then what's left on the other side. So they were very keen to make sure that there was some lasting infrastructure created out of this that, you know, had a payoff for their kids and for the community at large. So we heard a lot about training centres and a lot of different models, which I thought might be of interest for your discussion. So some were talking about upgrading existing industry facilities, like taking what's already there with the distribution networks or with Transgrid and trying to build training facilities on top of that. Some spoke about trying to expand agricultural training facilities to include renewables. And their argument was, well, you know, these are the industries that are here for the long term. Renewables, we know, is, you know, might have a 10 to 15 years, but we want to make sure it's embedded within something that's embedded in our local economy and is going to have that lasting effect. Some focused on rebuilding or taking what was in the TAFE system and trying to build training centres around that. Some wanted to see a completely greenfield site that they felt like you wanted to see something which was really had a primary focus on renewables and then would build other things around them. So, you know, there's quite an interesting array of potential models and worth thinking about, I guess, in the context of the Hunter, about not just, you know, we want a training centre, but what type of model is going to work best, because there's different options. I would say the other point also is, I think training centres is important, but there's a lot of other ways in which you can build training capacity, which are going to be quicker and cheaper, which is particularly important in the inland regions, given they're trying to build, you know, the stuff now, essentially, from, you know, mobile training units to pre-employment programs or drives to get young people construction tickets. There's a whole range of things that can be done which are, you know, quicker and cheaper as well, that can try and develop the local workforce. So needs to be a sort of mixed strategy. One other thing we've focused on is how to build employment and training pathways. Here, over and over again, when you talk to people, they say, oh, no young people know how to get a job in the sector. They wouldn't know where to start, what kind of jobs, what do they look like, whereas they all know how to get a job in the local mine or local farm or whatever. They just haven't actually built the pathways out yet. There needs to be awareness campaign. There needs to be vet training and accelerated pathways in schools where they lay out the pathways. One of the key conclusions we came to in particularly these inland regions is that they're going to need to be really tapping a whole range of different pathways because of the very difficult labour market circumstances they're in. So some of these might apply less to you or not as much. But there's a range of different ways in which we can build a workforce, and some of them I think have got great opportunities. There's also an opportunity to build, I guess, so secondly, build an opportunity where we try to draw people in from outside the labour market, particularly First Nations communities. There's one or two really good examples of solar farms drawing in local Indigenous unemployed, getting them started in a construction job, and then if they stick through that, then they start to get into an apprenticeship or other types of construction. So, you know, really good opportunity to address like socioeconomic disadvantage as well as finding a source of labour. I'm probably starting to run out of time here, but you can see here, I guess, and have a look at the presentation later, where we've got a range of different pathways and a range of different policies that needs to be developed to try and draw in these different types of labour to the sector. Lastly, we also put an emphasis on trying to improve the labour markets that operate in clean energy. I think it's fair to say that renewables have an image problem with workers sometimes. They have trouble attracting, retaining workers because of the casualised work, fragmented work, pay and conditions. It's one thing to kind of build the supply of labour and skills, but you need to be able to retain it if you're going to create a lasting solution. And in particular, I guess we put an emphasis on group training because solar farms don't, and in particular, construction is usually less than a year. Wind farms is a couple of years. It's not as long as an apprenticeship, of course, so you need group training solutions really if you're going to build an apprenticeship base within the renewable sector. And I guess some other things that would improve their portability and retention, from entitlements to collective bargaining to better skills recognition. So three basic conclusions. We're looking at a very rapid scale-up of the workforce if we're going to achieve the energy transition that governments are aiming for, and skill shortages could be a serious constraining factor. Not only, I guess, on whether we achieve the energy transition, but also the type of social and economic outcomes that come along with it. Like, one option is obviously that we end up trying to import a whole lot of workers and you get a fly-in, fly-out construction type situation, which is not great for anyone. So it's, you know, both about achieving the transition, but also about how we achieve the transition. I think it's essential we get a very rapid investment in training capacity, workforce development, and all these things to try and build the skills base, both for the construction phase that we're going to go through over the few years, but also because you need that if you're going to take advantage of the industry development opportunities from things like offshore wind If you don't have the capacity, then they're going to import that capacity. So you've got to build it alongside as the development phase for these sectors. So I'll finish there. Perfect. There you go. You doubted I could do in 20.
Thank you so much. We'll have time at the end for questions for everyone. In the interest of time, I'll keep it moving along. So next up is Sheena Martin. Sheena is from Business Hunter, which is the largest regional peak business group in Australia. Regional peak business group, representing 3,700 members and affiliates across 10 LGAs and 20 local chambers of commerce. She's an accomplished communications and media specialist with a passionate for advocacy, and prior to Business Hunter, she worked in her own business providing communications leadership for clients working in a range of industries, including critical minerals, emerging renewable technologies, and startups. So I'll let Sheena take it.
Actually, can I, did this pull out?
Yeah.
Because I'm going to be really bad at that if I don't hold on to the microphone. Thank you. Thanks for inviting myself and Business Hunter along, and for the Hunter Jobs Alliance for putting this on, and for all of you wonderful humans for being here, because this is a really, really critical conversation for the region. And so we're stoked to be here tonight. And Erin, I know you picked the date for tonight some time ago, but fantastic timing, because we had Bowen in town today and a number of us were at the Port of Newcastle talking about offshore wind and skills and the region's energy capacity. So a great fit for tonight. I do have a couple of slides. Erin's already done a great job of covering off who Business Hunter is. So for those of you that don't know, I may have given you some outdated stats. We are the peak voice for business for the region, covering 4,200 members, 10 LGAs, businesses of all sizes, ranging from startups through to the region's largest employers, and covering all sectors. And we work with all levels of government to provide advice and awareness of the issues, the key issues for the Hunter. So if you hit the next slide, Erin. Thank you. That's it. I am still relatively new at Business Hunter, but I'm acting CEO at the moment, but usually I'm the Policy and Public Affairs Manager. And when I started at Business Hunter last year, one of the things that I immediately worked on was a platform ahead of the state election to help the incoming government understand what the key priorities were for the region, and we worked with all of our members to understand what those key priorities are, and what fell out as one of the main priorities is the transition and the fact that it's simultaneously our biggest opportunity and our biggest challenge. And if we dive into some of that, I'll try not to overlap with what Chris said, and that was such a fantastic synopsis. In terms of the key opportunities, The opportunity to really reinforce what's here, and we are a world-class energy-producing region, and we have an amazing pedigree. And so we've got, a skilled workforce here to be able to leverage off. We've got businesses who are already, well and truly established in this space. So that gives us a fantastic platform to springboard from. Business attraction and economic development. One of the other things that I do a lot of at Business Hunter is touring around overseas delegations. And invariably, the one thing that they're all interested in at the moment is, you can probably guess, it's energy. So I hosted a delegation from Germany recently. We've got, I know there's a Japanese delegation coming soon. We've got an Indian roadshow happening. We had another one last year, and it's really their key priority. They do look at other things like tourism and maybe some export industries like wine and agriculture, that kind of thing, but really energy is their number one concern, and so that opportunity is really ours to lose. The other opportunities are jobs, for sure, but as Chris painted a picture, that's also a challenge, and it's over there in my challenge column. And in fact, excuse me while I just refer to a few notes I scratched down here today, but Minister Bowen was citing some stats at this press conference today: 3,000 construction jobs and over 1,500 ongoing jobs in the Hunter just for the offshore wind zone. So that's pretty incredible. And then if we look at challenges, it's listed first because it's the most important thing, but ensuring no business, community or worker is left behind. Funding was also something that, it's something that comes up regularly. So, you know, what's the best approach there? Do we scatter it around and fund a bunch of things, or do we maybe try and concentrate our efforts and focus on a couple of key priorities? The scale of the task ahead, and again, Chris did a really great job of that. Bowen's estimates these are just outstanding, I think. So in order for us to reach the end of the decade net zero targets, we need nationally 22,000 solar panels every day for the next 8 years. We need 40 wind turbines a month, and we need at least 10,000 kilometres of transition lines. So that's his estimation of what we'll need to install, and that's just incredible. And obviously, there are national targets, but we know that the government's looking to the Hunter to really, take a lot of the burden around the renewable energy industry. So it's a huge task ahead. And then jobs and housing, and actually if we go to the next slide, I can see Lionel. I saw Lionel sitting in the crowd. Yes, there he is, and Kempsey. Those guys know all about these stats. So, we are encountering unprecedented workforce shortages in the Hunter region. It is, aside from probably rising energy costs and maybe rising interest rates, the number one concern that we hear from businesses. And if we look at some of the stats, the average annual unemployment figures for Newcastle and Lake Mac have hit an all-time low of 3% since that data series commenced in 1999. I've read other stats that we haven't had workforce shortages like this since the 1970s, which is before I was born. And the trends in the Hunter are actually defying national trends and even state trends. So we're going in the opposite direction. And if you look at the internet job vacancy numbers, so that's the number of jobs that are being advertised, again, we're defying those national and state trends. So we had a little dip over at the end of the year, over Christmas, but they're rising, they're on the rise again. So, and last month, they increased another 200. So you can see there the percentage increases when you look at the sort of longer term trends over the last 12 months, a 6.8% increase in the Hunter compared with 4.2% at the national level and 9.6% for the state. So it's in terms of the task ahead, the task before us and the jobs that we require and the unemployment, the workforce shortages that we're dealing with, it is quite a conundrum. And if we consider the intersecting issues, so one of the main reasons why we have worker shortages in the Hunter is, and again, this is another key concern for business, there's no housing. So we can't bring workers in to fill shortages from elsewhere because there's nowhere for them to live. And so one of the businesses that actually worked with us on our platform, Mortels, that make UGG boots and that kind of thing near here, those guys were looking at bringing in labour, so sewers from overseas, and arranging housing for them. So bringing over 4 to 6 women and actually finding a house for them and putting them up because it was just absolutely impossible. So that's kind of the scale of, the issues that business is dealing with. So that policy document that I developed, so bearing all of that in mind, what we've asked for is to fund a new energy skills centre modelled on the Institute of Applied Technology at Meadowbank. Have any of you come across that? Have any of you seen it? Yeah, a few hands. It's an incredible facility. I should have actually included a link to a couple of their videos, but my husband's a chippy, and I showed him, and so they've got a facility there where people who are studying carpentry can actually build a two-story house in the facility, and it's all covered and air-conditioned, and then break it down again. And so people who are going through that trade can do that over and over, and it's a really compelling sell for students who are thinking about careers in those fields. And actually the feedback from that facility is that, you know, student numbers and therefore their pipeline is growing, because that is a world-class training facility and that's getting people excited about studying there. And it is actually a partnership between TAFE, a couple of universities, Macquarie and UTS, Chris, no wonder you are nodding, and Microsoft as well. And so we think there's real power in bringing together educators with industry, and, you know, a collaborative model really works when you think about some of the key challenges that we're dealing with in the education space. So, you know, some of the roles in the sector are still emerging, and as they emerge, we're going to need to be really agile and have educators working with industry in order to figure out what the education requirements are and how we train these new workers. New roles might actually straddle, you know, the roles of traditional tradespeople and university educated degrees. Some of the new technology, you know, in the renewables space hasn't even left the lab. I spent a year working with Professor Paul Dastor. I don't know if any of you are familiar with his work. He makes the really flexible, super thin printed solar cells. And he uses a traditional printing press to make those. So he used to make wine labels. It's incredible stuff. But, you know, they've developed the technology. They're working out how to manufacture it at scale. And now what he's doing is working on a master's course to actually train people in how, you know, that technology is going to potentially roll out. So you can kind of see, and he's working with industry as well, so you can sort of see how all of these challenges are kind of happening simultaneously, and we need to be agile and able to be working in an environment where all of those things can come together quickly. And to my last point, there's no time to lose. And I really don't mean to be banging on about the university here. They're just some examples that I'm personally aware of because I've come out of the higher education space, the University of Newcastle. But they've got $16 million to fund a whole bunch of equipment in renewable energy technology, so things that, you know, whiz and bang and all that kind of stuff. And we're mad not to leverage those sorts of platforms. There's no time to lose, I guess, is our message. And I think that might be my last slide. It is. Thank you all.
Thanks so much. Next up, we've got Lee Shears, Secretary of Hunter Workers, which is the peak body for unions in the Hunter, including 24 unions representing over 64,000 workers. Boilermaker by trade, he had his start at Shell Harbour TAFE and went on to become a delegate for the AMW and the campaigns organiser at Hunter Workers. He's a weapon on the megaphone, a top bloke, and was at the announcement today with Chris Bowen declaring the offshore wind zone, asking the hard questions about supply chain and how workers... supply chains, rather, and how workers in the Hunter can get the best benefit from investments coming here. So, thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Erin. And I am a good bloke. I just want to acknowledge country also, and also want to just reiterate Hunter Workers' commitment to, we've accepted the invitation from the Uluru from the Heart, so we encourage everyone to consider your voting yes at the upcoming referendum. Just thanks for the invitation to speak here tonight as well. It's an important... significant important issue, as we've all been all can agree, but also I want to thank the Hunter Jobs Alliance for the work that they've done, significantly turning the conversation around over the last couple of years. I was saying to someone today the Hunter Jobs Alliance was you know, they'll mark for, they'll on posters for, you know, they weren't well liked a couple of years ago, and it was kind of an expectation that the organisation would fall apart. There was no need for it, and today really centre in the conversation around this, these discussions as well. So I just want to talk to about I suppose, you know, the opportunities, benefits, challenges, and I'll sort of round it up with a bit of a conclusion as well. The opportunity. You know, as of February 2022, we were looking at the potential investment of over $100 billion in the Hunter and Central Coast Renewable Energy Zone. Now, to seize this moment and ensure a successful and fair transition, establishing a new energy training centre in the Hunter is imperative. By doing so, we can equip our workforce with the necessary skills and knowledge to thrive in emerging industries. Without a targeted focus on the needs of workers, both in traditional and emerging industry, including power stations and the mining sector, we ensure the fear and uncertainty felt during the climate wars of the previous decade will continue at the detriment of our regional communities. Workers and our families will continue to suffer. Now, the world is increasingly transitioning into renewable energy sources to power our communities and combat climate change. The Hunter Valley, rich in resources, industrial heritage, innovative people, are well positioned to become a world leader for these new industries. However, to fully embrace our potential, we need a skilled workforce that can drive innovation and build on the region's reputation, employment opportunities, career pathways, and economic competitiveness. Taking advantage of this industrial and social transition requires specialised skills that differ from the skills traditionally associated with the region's industries. By establishing a new industries training centre, we can bridge the skills gap and ensure that our workers are prepared for the jobs of the future, providing training pathways tailored to the specific needs of regional areas and industrial opportunity, from research, skills development, construction, advanced manufacturing and technology, to repair and maintenance. We can do it all here. As new industries develop and expand, new businesses will emerge, attracting investment and generating employment. A trained and upskilled workforce from the Hunter would be ideally positioned to take advantage of these opportunities, ensuring that our region remains prosperous and resilient. Establishing a new industries training centre would foster collaborative partnerships between industry, education institutions and government bodies, such as the Hunter Regional Transition Authority and the recent announcement with the Federal Net Zero Authority. These partnerships would facilitate knowledge sharing, research and development, and continuous upskilling to keep pace with evolving industry needs. By working together, we can build a robust ecosystem that supports innovation and drives sustainable economic growth, all the while protecting our environment. I just want to talk about the benefits of workers and communities. Workers in the broader community will play a pivotal role in the industrial transition and emerging industries. By establishing a targeted training centre, we can ensure confidence in our region's workforce now and for the future. Empowering workers give certainty to our communities and ensure a fair and inclusive transition. The workers of the Hunter Valley have been the backbone of our industries for generations. As we embark on the path towards renewable energy, it is essential to empower the region's workers with the skills and knowledge required for the emerging jobs. Providing people and confidence to access high-quality training tailored to community need and industrial opportunity. This empowers workers to actively participate in the transition, secure sustainable employment, and contribute to and benefit from the success of the sector. A fair transition centred around worker and community justice means ensuring that workers and their families do not bear the brunt of economic upheaval and the cultural shift. By investing in TAFE, government, industry and employers demonstrate a commitment to supporting workers and communities throughout this transition and beyond. This approach ensures that workers can transition with confidence and dignity, maintaining livelihoods while embracing new opportunities with confidence and certainty. We can strengthen the entire community, With the right focus and policy settings, we foster resilience to ensure our region remains vibrant and economically diverse. A skilled workforce with expertise will attract new business and investment, providing opportunities for job creation and local economic growth. This in turn supports the prosperity and well-being of the entire community. This industrial transition presents an opportunity to localise the benefits and wealth generated by the renewable sector. By establishing a new industry training sector, we equip our local workforce with the skills to fill the new jobs that will be created, reducing the reliance on external talent, ensuring that economic benefits circulate within our local communities. Local workers become the driving force behind sustainable development, supporting small business, leading to increased prosperity and shared opportunities for our region. Challenges. And we've heard, you know, previous speakers talk about many of the challenges. Politics, teachers, support staff and accessibility. One, political will. Our political leaders need to recognise the investment in targeted industry policy through a new industries training centre in the Hunter is not only good education policy, it is good public policy. As noted previously, equipping workers of today and tomorrow with the skills and knowledge to participate in the opportunities of the future sets our region up for sustainable, prosperous communities. And it's not rocket science. Industry-focused training centres are essential. A couple of examples. Cyber Security Innovation Centre. This centre focuses on delivering industry-relevant training and certifications to address the skills gap in cybersecurity. Tourism and Hospitality Academies caters for the specific needs of the tourism and hospitality industry, construction and building trades. Industry-focused initiatives in the construction and building sector and creative industries. Recognise the significance of creating industries offering specialised training programs. Two, teachers and related employees. In 2012, there was over 17,000 teachers and related staff in the New South Wales TAFE. In 2020, there was 9,000 teachers and related employees left in New South Wales TAFE, completely covered. The upskilling of teachers and staff is critical to preparing a skilled workforce for current and emerging industries. It is essential to recognise and address the challenges faced in equipping educators with the necessary knowledge and expertise. It is also essential to recognise that to maintain a skilled workforce committed to training workers for industry, they too need to be respected, have access to secure, well-paid employment. Accessibility. The cost of getting into or upskilling has gone through the roof. While adding HECS-style debt systems to tertiary education has led to significantly reduced enrolments, course completions and financial stress. Workers in our community should not be burdened by excessive costs for aspiring to better their own lives and in doing so, adding value to our local economies. Education and skills development is an investment that adds value to the economies and security to families of our communities. Now, when I was growing up, TAFE was the pathway to a bright and secure future following school. Everyone felt this. TAFE was properly funded and supported by industry and government. Now, I grew up in a domestic violent household, so going to school was an escape, the opportunity to get away. So by the time high school was over, I had no idea what to do or where to go to next. We had no money or access to support. Shellharp and TAFE was the obvious next step. I was guided by the TAFE teachers in what would become my career for the next 27 years. I've become a boilermaker. Without easy, affordable access to TAFE, I believe my mother would have died by domestic violence. It was the low cost, $50 administration fee, and ease of access to enrol that began the journey to freedom and realising my mother's dreams. TAFE provided social connection, confidence and skills to leave her marriage, secure a permanent position at the University of Wollongong, and be a valued worker supporting academics for the next 30 years until her retirement. TAFE is an asset for communities, an invaluable asset for our society. So in conclusion, we have a tremendous opportunity to lead the way in clean energy technologies and advanced manufacturing. By establishing a new industries training centre, we can continue to develop the skilled workforce, bridge the skill gaps, creating local opportunities, career pathways, and certainty for our people. This centre would serve as a catalyst for innovation, collaboration, skills development. A new industries training centre within the already committed manufacturing centre of excellence would be world-leading and signal to our communities and the world that here in the Hunter Valley, we support our people. We know our shit and get things done. We can ensure happy and healthy communities, industrial innovation and participation, economic growth in a sustainable environment. There are challenges ahead for all of us, for our energy workers and supporting industries, watching their power stations close, for our coal communities that see no tangible alternatives around them to have confidence for the future, for our teachers and educators that have not been supported by governments, for those who care about our environment, for the kids of the future. If we learn from our past, if we do it right, we can transition together. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Lee, and thanks for bringing that wider point about restoring the whole of TAFE to the level the community requires. That's an even bigger journey that our Affiliate Teachers Federation could probably spend a whole other forum explaining. Apparently, there have been some promising signs on the horizon with the federal and state governments now committing to 70% of funding for vocational education going to TAFE and doing away with the contestable funding model, but I'm sure there's much more to be won, and we stand in solidarity with the unions fighting to rebuild TAFE on that broader scale. Last speaker is Warwick Jordan, who probably doesn't need much of an introduction, but I'm going to give one anyway. Our former coordinator spent some time prior to being with HJA as the Hunter Region Employment Facilitator for the Australian Government Department of Education, Skills and Employment, and his new gig is at the Institute for Regional Futures, University of Newcastle.
Great, thanks, Erin. Look, I didn't want to speak for too long, but I just wanted to give a run through. I think it's worthwhile recapping why something like this new industry training centre is necessary, both in terms of the energy transition, but also servicing a statewide need. I think it's important to talk about why the Hunter is a good place for it. And then the thing I wanted to cover off at the end was about how, as a community, we go about trying to land this in the region. So just for starters, and without getting too sort of Donald Rumsfeld about this, like there's no knowns, right, about what we need. I think Chris has covered that off really well. We're building a hell of a lot of renewable energy. You know, a lot of it we can't see from our veranda here, but it will come our way sooner or later. But there's a really clear pipeline of need if we don't train humans to build those transmission lines, to build those wind and solar farms, to do all the other things that are needed. We're going to have a real constraint in the system getting to where we need to. So that's essential. Then there's a set of known unknowns, and that's all about industries like offshore wind, industries like hydrogen, where we know there's substantial opportunities here, but we also know it's incredibly competitive, whether that's domestically, whether that's for other places. There's investors who are looking around the world and thinking, okay, where are we going to put our dollars? And we know that the availability of skilled labour is a swing criteria for a lot of investors. Now, if you talk to the people from the state government who work on attracting investors to the Hunter and also New South Wales, one of the biggest barriers that happens is that they're running through the list of criteria for investors, and we tick a lot of boxes, but oftentimes we don't quite get there as far as the accessibility of skilled labour, and that applies as much to renewable energy and clean energy and related industries as it does to anything else. I think at the end of the day, really what it comes down to is that we're trying to meet the needs that we have for a skilled workforce to do what we need to do in terms of the energy transition and in terms of creating industries and opportunities for people in the future. The second thing is we need to concentrate on illustrating those pathways for young people, and a couple of speakers have spoken about that already, and we need to make sure that we've got that labour force there so that we can attract that investment. So I think the reasons are really clear. New South Wales, different to other states in that Victoria, Queensland, they already have training centres like this. In both cases, they've got a couple now. And so I think there is a really compelling argument for New South Wales to have one, which leads us to why the Hunter. As Chris has spoken about, anywhere that's seeing renewable energy being built is going to want those benefits of training, and they're going to want that bricks and mortar. I think it is a matter of looking at where are the logical places, and I think some of the things that we see from TAFE already are probably a helpful steer to start thinking about it. I know Sheena spoke about the Institutes of Applied Technology. You know, I was lucky enough to go down with TAFE to look at the one at Meadowbank last year. It's an extraordinary facility, and I think there's no good reason why we can't do something quite similar for renewable energy and related industries. But where it helps as far as needing a statewide centre and why it should be here. So there's a good model around hub and spoke. So you build the bricks and mortar centre, which is where the base of the training is, where the teaching workforce is centred, and where most people will go for a lot of their training. But it gives you the basis then to then send that out to other places in the state. Why the Hunter is a really good place for this, and Chris spoke about it, is that we have the existing capacity institutions, we have a population base. Yes, there is a strong argument, I think, for places like Dubbo or other places where you do have renewable energy zones, but it would be logical to have the core base in the place where you have the population centre, you can attract the training, and where you have existing facilities and institutions like TAFE, like the University of Newcastle, who are already starting to do these things. And so I think it's probably not valuable for the Hunter to get in a competition with, the Central West or the North West or what have you about, needing one of these places everywhere. I think it's about being collaborative and saying, okay, there's a point of logic about why it should be here in the Hunter, and we can build off our existing capacity, but that means we need to create something that will serve the rest of the state as well. And I think the last thing that I'd really like to reflect on is the Hunter, as a place, is generally big enough to come up with good ideas, but we're also small enough to argue about whose version of that idea should be created. And the problem with that is then we end up in a situation where other places get the jump on us, or good ideas just go somewhere to die. What we really need in this situation, where we have a really clear policy driver, which is to create this renewable energy and related industries workforce. We've got a really good case here in the Hunter. We're starting to see, both from state and federal government, the capacity to invest. And the Hunter, the fact that we have had these, 10 years of debate and argument or what have you, climate culture wars or whatever people want to call it, now that I think we're coming out the other side of that, that sort of gives us an advantage, because we've become the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. Governments want to do things for this region because they know people are worried about these things. But just because there's a policy need, and just because governments are interested in doing things in this region, doesn't mean it's going to happen unless we can have a coherent proposal and we can have people working with each other. And I think it's really encouraging to come to a Hunter Jobs Alliance forum where you've got Hunter workers, Business Hunter, you've got the university, you've got people who are coming from elsewhere who know things about this industry and what we need, saying, look, this is a good idea. And so the challenge for here from this point is for key stakeholders to make sure that we make that clear and coherent pitch so that government knows what we want and that they know the Hunter will be a home for this place that will be easy for them to invest in and easy to execute. So we're in a really good position, but the next little while is going to be pivotal. There's funds for these type of training investments. You know, there's studies happening through Jobs and Skills Australia. There's the national partnerships being agreed around training. There's reforms happening around TAFE. There's the funding that Sheena mentioned that the University of Newcastle already has and is looking to collaborate on these kind of things. So really good opportunity, but we really do have to strike while the iron's hot. So really great that we've got these groups together, that we've got Hunter Jobs Alliance making a really good, strong public case around this, and it should be a great opportunity if we can get the leaders of the community and we can get the broader community behind it. There's no reason why we can't land this here. Thanks.
Thanks, Warwick. And I think, the other good reasons are, from a justice point of view, you know, with people moving out of traditional industries in the Hunter, we need opportunities for young people to see jobs coming in their futures. And part of that is putting the flag up and saying, well, the Hunter's open for business and we're ready for new industries to set up here. But yes, as Warwick was saying, we know that this kind of investment may not be easy and will require that united message and effort from stakeholders here. And so to that end, I wanted to read out the following statement, which was endorsed by the Hunter Jobs Alliance, Business Hunter and Hunter Workers, which is simply, the Hunter is attracting investment in renewable energy developments, decarbonising industry and new sectors such as battery manufacturing, green hydrogen and offshore wind. We can be a global leader in clean energy and advanced manufacturing. To secure this future, we need a job-ready workforce to fill crucial skills gaps and attract further investment. Now is the time for industry, educators and the government to work together to meet the urgent demands of our region's future workforce. A Hunter-based skills centre could make use of industry expertise and existing facilities and capabilities at TAFE and the University of Newcastle. It could create clear pathways for workers and meet vocational training needs for renewable energy, clean technology, hydrogen and decarbonised manufacturing across New South Wales. By funding a world-class facility, we will ensure the Hunter people continue to play a key role in the New South Wales economy. We can prosper through the changes to our regional economy, acquire higher quality skills and secure jobs for generations to come. So yeah, we want to use that statement as a basis for coalition, further coalition building. Any organisation not represented so far is welcome to sign on to that. And we to really build that united case for this investment. Secure those jobs of the future for the Hunter. So let's keep the conversation going. Time for a little question and answer.